I read this. All right, good morning, and welcome to the morning meeting of the students at McGill at Invest in Management program here in the Desotel Faculty of Management. While we study in the Invest in Management program, we are also working for Desotel Capital Management, a registered investment management firm, which is a manager of the Desotel Global Equity Fund and the Desotel Fixed Income Fund. This morning, you will hear some investment ideas and investment research from students in the first year of the program. You will also be able to ask questions after their presentations. There will also be coffee and pastries afterwards if you have a few minutes at the end to meet with them. So let me just start. My name is Tigran. I'm the currency strategist for the fund, and today I'm going to discuss the macro view and the currency view of the fund and how we position ourselves towards the benchmark. So just to start with this is our portfolio with the sector allocation. And as you can see here, we are overweight mostly defensive sectors, and we are underweight mostly aggressive sectors while holding 10% more or less cash. And also, please take note of the currency exposure, which is massively overweight the U.S. dollar. And the reason for that is that the U.S. dollar is a countercyclical currency, which tends to appreciate when risky assets sell off. So this is another way for us to add to our negative bias towards the markets. So why do we have this negative bias? Well, let's just look at where the economy is at right now. This is when the bubble burst. This is a simple chart just to illustrate my point. So we had economic weakness, which was caused by the private sector deleveraging. But then Lehman happened, which was not supposed to happen, which caused extra pressure on the system because credit markets completely froze. A lot of companies went bust, which were not supposed to go bust. So, and then policymakers reflated the assets. They gave everything they could. And right now we're here, the red dot. So because the slump was so deep, if you look at rate of change or year-over-year figures, everything looks vertical. Everything looks V-shaped. But keep in mind that the base year, which are 2009, was so bad that it's hard to see if we're really in the recovery phase or we're just in a kind of a square root scenario where you see a very sharp recovery, but then the structural headwinds, which I believe we're facing, is going to temper the recovery. So we're really facing two forces right now, especially in the U.S., also in Europe, but mostly in the U.S., which is cyclical tailwinds propping the economy up, mostly government and monetary stimulus. But then you have the private sector deleveraging. So the question is the tailwind going to last long? Is the headwind stronger, whichever the economy is going to go? So let's just start by looking at what the markets are pricing. So here I'm just using a very simple forward P scenario. And as you can see here, forward P's have recovered to the pre-crisis level where here, as you can see here in 2006, we didn't have any structural headwinds. Everything was rosy. Everything was beautiful in the U.S. So right now, I believe, looking at this forward P, I believe markets are not pricing in enough of that structural headwinds. So I see multiple contractions going forward. And just to mention some of the structural headwinds I've been talking about, well, first of all, everyone knows the U.S. households are very heavily indebted, and their leverage is at 100% GDP. And it's okay to have 100% GDP, debt to GDP, as long as your income is growing. The problem in the U.S. is that with what happened in the labor market, this chart is all the nominal labor income produced in the private sector, which has been negative for the first time since the Second World War. So not only leverage is very high, and households will have to face balance sheet adjustments, but nominal labor income is negative. So households are very sensitive to interest rates right now. If the Fed starts raising interest rates, you're going to see a lot of savings rate either go up or consumption going down. And also, they're very sensitive to asset price deflation. And I'm going to talk about the house prices in the U.S. later, but they're very sensitive to that in terms of net worth. And so the only way, given that leverage is so high and nominal labor income is negative, the only way retail sales can go up is through lower savings rate. And surprisingly, that's what's been happening in the U.S. because savings rate went up from 1% to 5.5%, but then came down to 4%, which is quite surprising given that recession, technically recession is over, but a lot of data that's coming in shows that demand is not picked up, really. So, employment too. So risk aversion has subsided in the household sector. And retail sales have picked up somewhat. But this is what I was talking about. If you look at the rate of change basis, this is vertical. But if you look at the absolute level of retail sales, it's still pretty far off from this 07 high peaks. So, and this matters because absolute level retail sales determines inventory level for companies, determines the level of production of the economy, determines the capital structure. So I see Wall Street expects this to go up vertical, but given what's happening both in the labor market and both the balance sheet adjustments from households, I believe savings rate's going to go up back to 6-7% perhaps in order for them to start paying down their debt or reduce their leverage, and the retail sales recovery is not going to be as vertical as people expect. So that's one thing. Also, I was mentioning house prices. They haven't recovered at all, both in terms of price and in terms of volume. So households were expected that they were expecting that perhaps the house prices were undershooting their fair value, but it seems that it's not the case. And once they come to that realization, you're going to see massive negative wealth effect, which means negative wealth effect is when you have your net worth is depressed, and because of that, you consume less because you tend to save more for the future. And so a lot of structural stuff going on in the U.S., and I didn't even mention commercial real estate, which is a huge problem, nor the U.S. regional banks, the 700 regional banks, which are on the brink of bankruptcy. So talking about regional banks, the sector which is really leveraged to that is small businesses in the U.S. And this is the NFIB survey, which is published, I think, monthly. And it's not looking good at all, both in terms of demand, capital spending plans, and hiring plans. And don't forget, small businesses is the largest employer in the United States. So if you see hiring plans below the boom bust level, below the 0% boom bust level, this is really not looking good for the U.S. households. And you really see a world of difference. The S&P 500 large caps, in the MD&A analysis, you see, we see sales growth going forward, earnings have somewhat recovered. But looking at the small businesses, which are still suffering, both because of demand, but also because of credit, which is tight, well, I think there's two kind of worlds in the U.S. right now. Right now, people are discounting mostly what's happening with the S&P, but once they come to that realization, what's happening in the small businesses that have not recovered, well, you're going to see market sell off. Also, the cyclical tailwinds, which I was mentioning, I think they're coming to an end. This is the fiscal thrust, which has been massive both in Europe and in the U.S. But keep in mind, the debt-to-GDP ratio is coming to very high levels, and already the Moody's and S&P rating agencies have been warning the U.S. that, well, don't go too far because we might, the AAA rating is not a guarantee completely. Fiscal stimulus, unlikely to expect more fiscal stimulus or large fiscal stimulus going forward. And also on the monetary side, well, central banks have propped up their balance sheet massively, and I don't see more help coming from them either because if they continue buying assets at this level, I think it's actually going to have a negative signal for the markets. So, and they're already at the almost 0% in the case of the U.S. and almost zero for the euro too. So the only way they can prop up is quantitative easing, but I don't believe it's possible at this point. Also, I was mentioning the market liquidity, which is it's basically all the money that the central bank injects in the system, which doesn't go to the real sector, which actually goes to the asset markets. So the way I calculate this is basically M1, real M1 growth minus industrial production growth. So all the money that goes to the asset markets. And this is the blue line here. And as you can see here, it has completely rolled over. And keep in mind that the blue line has been either a leading or a coincidental indicator to the P multiple in the U.S. So this also signals a multiple contraction going forward. Lastly, for the cyclical stuff, China, their exports and their credits going vertical. And already policymakers have started their tightening cycle with both interest rates and the reserve requirement here. And although this is not going to affect the U.S. directly, but at the margin, it means less demand, less capital spending in China, which means less demand for some of U.S. capital goods. So at the margin, it's not really good at either. And already you see real estate investments in China cooling off. They were at 40% year-over-year a couple of months ago. Right now they're at almost at zero. Infrastructure and construction stocks in China actually peaked in mid-09. They peaked on an absolute level. So perhaps there's a mini bubble in Chinese real estate. So bottom line, just to conclude, cyclical tailwinds, I believe, are losing strength, and the structural headwinds are approaching. Markets are not discounting that enough, in my opinion. So we're maintaining a defensive position for next 3 to 9 months. And with the option of remaining in this position longer if the bear market is with low volatility and with kind of a long time interval bear market. And also, as I mentioned, we're favoring the U.S. dollar over the Canadian dollar simply because if you look at the dotted line here, which is the 100-day moving correlation of the Canadian dollar and U.S. dollar exchange rate with the S&P 500, it's been above 0.8. So the Canadian currency is very highly cyclical, very pro-cyclical. So the U.S. dollar will tend to appreciate in times of downturn. So any questions? Yeah. The question was basically what the effect of the window dressing by portfolio managers is going to have, because they're going to show their portfolios in 2 weeks, you said, for Q1. I believe it's very hard to forecast market based on flows. It's never a good idea to try and forecast markets on looking at who's buying and who's selling, because these data are always kind of estimates and they're very volatile. So I understand what you're saying. At the margin, maybe to have a slightly positive effect, but there's tons of pension funds and those really big mammoths. They don't need to do as much window dressing as perhaps mutual funds. So at the margin, it's hard to say what's the net effect going to be, but I wouldn't try to analyze the market based on funds. I mean, funds of flows. Yeah.
The forward P?
Correct. So, you said you're expecting a multiple contraction.
Yeah.
Over that time period, what would you say the average growth rate of forward earnings was on the S&P 500?
The average growth rate for next
the
year?
The implied growth rate, yeah.
So, the trailing P is at 22, so I would say probably 8%.
Okay. So, then basically, if you expect a multiple contraction, what you're saying is that you expect the going forward growth rate of the S&P 5 earnings, given the cyclical headwinds and the structural headwinds, that goes to 6, 5, 4, 3?
I don't know the exact number. It's really on a more directional call than kind of timing the market or kind of timing the amplitude. But the real driver for U.S. stocks in the end is retail sales, because not only did it determine you know, obviously consumer staples and discretionary, but all the suppliers of consumer staples and discretionary and capital goods and intermediate goods in the U.S., it's all determined by retail sales. So for me, believing that retail sales is going to be, the recovery is going to be really sluggish, well, it and drives me to believe that multiple contraction is going to happen. I don't know if it's 4%, 5%, perhaps in some somewhere in that range.
That then leads me to another question, is that if the GDP, that number, that aggregate, like peaked at probably like $13 trillion, and that's a composition of multiple sectors. So if you take a look at it from a sectorial basis, right now, like healthcare, $2.2 trillion is basically 17% goes to healthcare, but I mean, the bulk of that spend is spent on maybe 2% of the population that's really, really sick.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm going with this is that back in 1965, when the S&P 5 first started, that index, the largest sector there was materials at over 35%. So theoretically, you could definitely, you're getting a shift sectorially already where maybe retail sales going forward is not that important. I mean, the prop up in retail sales probably is more to do with financial engineering, people getting 20 credit cards than actually make people making a ton of money.
Well, look at it this way. The financials in the U.S., in terms of profit, the profits of financials as percentage of total GDP or as a percentage of the S&P is huge. And a lot of that is trading and investment banking stuff, but a lot of that is also, given the yield curve is so steep, they can lend to consumers at very hard margins, both the credit cards and all kinds of mortgage business. And this is determined by retail sales, well, in some sense, and also by the housing market, and also by willingness for consumers to take on credit. So I think these three factors are going to be negative in going forward. So I'll already discount financials. I don't believe their earnings growth. The real financials, not the investment banking, which is very hard to forecast stuff. And then look at the materials. So I mentioned China. Their real real estate investments has been zero right now. It's year over year. Where if you look at the copper price, it hasn't moved at all. It's still almost at its peak. So I think there's an adjustment to be made in materials as well. So I think material stocks also are going to suffer. Energy, harder to predict. IT also. But IT is an early cyclical. I think all the liquidity that was injected in the system and capital spending that started, it's already in the market. So what demand was there for IT, which IT did really well last two quarters. I think it's already is priced in, and it was a kind of a one-off thing. So even though, like, as you mentioned, perhaps the consumer sector is not as big in the S&P, but there's a lot of things that are related to the consumer which are perhaps hidden. And I think those sectors are also going to be affected.
So then what you're saying is consistent with the allocation on a sectorial basis. I don't know what the stock selection is called. I mean, how many companies do you have in the portfolio? How many stocks do you have in the portfolio?
We have probably 10. Yeah, but we have ETFs too. Kind of winding down our ETF position to add to our stock selection right now. Thank you.
All right, my name is Jamie. I'm going to talk to you about CPFL Energia. All right, so this is corporate profile. CPFL, founded in 1912 with a 2004 IPO, holding company in the Brazilian electricity sector, and they operate through subsidiaries in generation, distribution, and commercialization. What I have posted there on that table is the market share in Brazil for each of those different businesses, as well as the percent of firm revenues that they represent and the net margins. So you can see there that generation right now is a small percent of the firm revenue, a small percent of the market share in Brazil. The margins are great. So that's going to be an important theme for me going forward through the presentation. In terms of the structure of the company, it's a bit interesting. They have a 30.5% free float, and then the rest is owned by large pension funds in Brazil and There's a large national bank as well that has a big position. And you can see there as well that there's, because they're a holding company, there are a lot of companies in their distribution, the commercialization and generation businesses. In terms of geography, the commercialization covers all of Brazil, and then the generation and distribution are clustered. So, and that's there's synergies created with that between the subsidiaries. Here's just a graph of the price over the last 4 years. So right now, as of Friday's close, it's $62.52. It's actually almost at $64 now, so should have bought this a bit earlier. But market cap, $10 billion, PE, just under 15. Right now, the dividend on an annual basis is just under $4, which represents 6.37% yield. And last year, they had earnings per share of $4.41 on a float of 157 million shares. This is just comparing it to the iShares Brazil ETF and then the MSCI World, which is our benchmark. So MSCI World over the past 4 years has, you know, slumped and, you know, it's creeping back up, double dip maybe. Whereas the EWZ had a huge run up, huge dramatic fall in 08, and it's picked up quite some steam there. And CPL, because it's a lower beta utility company, 0.61 beta. It's hasn't done quite as well as the EWZ, but it's done quite a bit better than the MSCI World. So looking at the Brazilian electricity sector, 2010 power demand estimated to be 9.4%, which is 2 times GDP growth estimates, and that's from Empresa, which is a Brazilian agency. Electricity consumption is to rise 5.2% annually from 2010 to 2018. Some catalysts for that are the $340 billion in infrastructure spending that's been taking place over the past 2 years, as well as venues that need to be built for the 2014 World Cup and then again for the 2016 Olympics. 89% of the electricity supply by hydroelectric generation facilities, and then natural gas and biomass supply the other 11% in Brazil. Private companies own 38% of generation and 68% of distribution. There's a large government-owned company that kind of runs the rest of the market. They have a dual market set up in the electricity sector, so there's a regulated and free. Regulated, the authorities, they decide how much energy to be contracted and then the list of projects to participate in auctions. And then in the free market, you have margin pressure because you don't have that monopolistic situation. But there's also little oversight, so it's the balance there. Looking at the Brazilian economy, that's important for CPL. 4% growth in payrolls in 2009, so it's due to an expansion of real household income. Creation of 995,000 jobs. There's been a recovery in credit operations. They now exceed pre-crisis levels. And 4Q09 industrial consumption increased year over year. So we can see here there's a percentage over the past quarters over the past 2 years or so. You can see here we had 2.9% growth in fourth quarter. And consumption. And then in production, this is just a seasonally adjusted index. And from December 08 through December 09, we've had an 18.1% year-over-year increase. Just looking back at 2009 for the firm, distribution, a 9% increase in operating revenues, but a 15% decrease in net income. So there's a tariff adjustment which contributed to the increase in operating revenues for the regulated market. There's a 2% increase in captive market energy sales. But there was a 15% increase in the cost of electric power that was purchased for resale. So despite the fact that the top line was good, bottom line growth was negative. But we did have a fourth quarter 09 year-over-year increase of 9%, showing that things are recovering, which is in line with industrial demand. In commercialization, there's 4% decrease in net income. There was, again, contracted industrial demand, but there was a 6% increase in residential and commercial demand for the year, and that's evident by the increase in real household income. And businesses picking up in 2009. Generation is where they really had a good year. So 48% increase in net income. That was due to some startups they have going on. We'll look at the CapEx profile in a few slides. Tariff-free adjustments again for generation. And their cost of electric power decreased 40%. It's important to note as well, again, as I said earlier, that generation is, you know, they have a 2% market share, but the margins are huge and it only represents 8% of their revenues rate or of their net income right now. But the installed capacity is going to increase 36% in 2010 alone. And then they also have projects coming due in 2011, 2012. So consolidated, putting all this together, they had a 9% increase in operating revenue and just about a 1% increase in net income. And this was despite national power demand contraction of 1.1%. So I'm going to talk about the strengths and the risks of the company. I'm going to talk about the risks first, highlight those. Regulation, that's always a big thing when you're dealing with a foreign company. Unexpected capital expenditures. It hasn't happened recently, but you know the government has been known to make utility firms invest in certain things, improve certain things that you know they otherwise would wait for a different time to do. Slow tariff adjustments. If we expect inflation in Brazil, if the tariff adjustments are not following that, there's going to be a decrease in the bottom line, and concession changes as well. A double dip is another possibility. I know Tigran made reference that the recovery is maybe not as what it seems. So lower energy prices through reduced demand, and that also brings up payment delinquency for residential consumers if that were to happen. The rise of free consumers. So right now, the free consumers, so that's the free market, again, there's that regulated in the free market, represents 7% of their net operating revenues. And there's new legislation in Brazil now so that captive users of alternative energy, it'll be easier for them to become free users, and which would put pressure on the margins of CPL. The 30.5% free float that I mentioned earlier, majority owners, they could have a misaligned view of the firm. That's always an issue when you don't have that 100% free float. And then the real depreciation. Right now, 23% of their debt is denominated in USD or yen, and they use swaps to convert that back. If the real does depreciate, there'd be an increased cost of their debt servicing, increased cost of purchasing electricity from their major facility, which uses a U.S. dollar cost to adjust what they charge, and reduced U.S. dollar value of dividends, which will be important for the fund. In the short term, I don't really have a view on the real. I mean, they've put some taxes in to cool the real appreciation, but I think in the longer term, unless we do get something like a double dip where money's been taken out of Brazil, it's not that big of a risk going forward. But again, foreign exchange risk is something that's becoming more and more important, especially for the fund. So something to definitely keep in mind. So those are the risks. Looking at the strengths, energy sales, there's the foreseeable increase due to the recovery in industrial demand. The captive market, it's always great when you're a monopoly. That's where the majority of the revenues, 93%, are derived from. Distribution tariffs, so there's regulator-led increases, which are favorable for the commercialization sales. Predictability as well, they've had stable margins. Even in the downturn, their margins did not get hit too hard. And they've had recent positive earnings surprises as well, so news to the upside. Strong concession agreements. So their first expiration does not expire until 2015, and they have a 20-year option to renew at that point. So that's not a risk in the short term. And a diversified portfolio. In 2009, distribution underperformance was partially compensated by generation. So they have vertical and horizontal setup. So they in the vertical, they're involved in all components of the value chain. Again, the generation, commercialization, distribution. And then horizontally, they've mainly been hydroelectric because that's what Brazil's electricity market has historically been. But now they're building into biomass and wind operations, which I'll get to right now. So, yeah, the graph actually, because it got transferred over. But anyways, the confirmed CapEx allocation, you might wonder why this looks like they're spending less money. But that's just because this is what they have confirmed going forward. So, again, distribution maintenance and distribution expansion, which are these two. And then you have the generation. So out of that dark bar generation going forward, 2010-2014, 54% of that's going to be going into their new wind operations, 15% to go into their hydro, and 23% to the biomass thermo, and then 8% for other things that they need to spend money on. A DCF valuation, just some assumptions. So required equity return, 7.7% based on the 10-year treasury. It's an ADR, so it's on the New York Stock Exchange, which is why we use the U.S. figures. Beta, again, 0.61, and the market risk premium, 6.5. I've used 8% revenue growth from 2010-2012, and then 4% for 2013-2014, Brazilian GDP estimate. And electricity demand growth is estimated to be 9.2%, so I think it's pretty conservative. Terminal value growth of 4.5%, and electricity demand expected, again, to increase 5.2%, so I think it's pretty conservative. And then I use a gross margin equal to a five-year average over the past 5 years, which has been pretty stable, so I think that's a pretty good proxy. And then just a constant change of working capital, because it's not, you know, in 2008 they had a negative investment working capital, and then 2009 it was really positive, so I just took an average over the last 5 years and smoothed that out. And it gave me an intrinsic value of about $67. So there's just a look at the model. Again, you got the revenue growth, the 4% there. I added the terminal value into this portion right here, into there, discounted all back, present value. Sensitivity, so there's a weighted average cost of capital. Here's revenue growth. And what I have represented here is when intrinsic value is greater than the current share price, which is all these numbers. So I even think revenue growth could be higher than that. It certainly will not be lower than 1%. I think in the worst case scenario, it would be Brazilian GDP, which is right around this level. There's investments. Again, WACC sensitive, that's important. So that goes into the exchange rate risk. So that's something to keep in mind. Looking at some comparables, it's a bit tricky. I note here because there's no peer play comparables for CPL because of the diversification of their portfolio and just the size they are in Brazil compared to other companies. So what I have here is the market cap, a forward PE, the S&P rating, debt equity, revenue growth for the last year, a dividend yield realized over the last year, EV over EBITDA, trailing 12 months, EBIT margins, return equity, and ROA. I note here the stability of cash flows. They have a higher forward PE, AA plus S&P rating, which I'm going to talk to in a second, given the highest relative debt-to-equity ratio, and year-over-year revenue growth. So looking at their dividend policy, this graph shows the yield and the price. So on this side would be what the dividend is over a year and then also the yield. And then this is over the past about 4 years and then forecasted forward just using a consensus estimate from Bloomberg. And their policy states that 50% of their net earnings distribute semi-annually. That's a minimum. In 2009, for example, they distributed 95% of their net earnings. So they have the money for their CapEx and they're distributing everything back up through because they're the holding company, so they distribute up to their shareholders and also through to the free float. The AA plus S&P rating, the only Brazilian firm with this rating, so that does reflect their stability and the fact that they do generate quite a bit of cash. And you can see that in 2000, they had the IPO in 2004, and they were an A and then A plus, AA minus, now they've AA plus, and then even I have Fitch ratings here as well, and they confirm that. So to conclude, recommendation, recommend a buy on the stock. We expect full recovery and future increases to industrial demand, and EBITDA was sensitive to the 2008 contraction as well. Investments in biomass and wind power sources. So the ProInfa is legislation put forth by the Brazilian government. So the alternative sources will supply 15% of the annual market growth until it reaches 10% of annual electric power demand. That's a 20-year initiative put forth. So you might have been wondering why they're putting all this money in towards wind and biomass in terms of their capital expenditures. That's why. There's legislation there to make it easier for them to do that. And CPL is well-positioned, again, due to that CapEx allocation. So they are looking forward. Regulatory agencies to further increase tariffs. So foreseeable reaction to the growth in real household income. So, again, if we think of the inflation, you're going to have these things like the tariffs coming up, which is pretty foreseeable. And this is favorable for their commercial operations in terms of the money coming in. And then, again, the forecast increases in the dividend payout. It's another positive. So current price, $62.52 at Friday's close. I have a 12-month target of $67 based on that DCF output. And then I would hold further unless there's signs of a dividend cut or if they're not going to increase it and there's signs of evident that there's deteriorating and you know, something happens to their cash flows, which I don't see, but it's always possible. So that's something to be aware of. Thank you.
Yeah. What's the current install base in terms of capacity, like megawatts capacity?
It's 1,700 megawatts,
I think
is what it is.
Okay. And of that, how much is regulated versus non-regulated?
7% of their operations are regulated. So 7% of the 17, and it's going to go up again 36% in terms of that total output.
Understood. And that's split in terms of like capacity, like hydro, wind.
Oh, sorry, take it. Yes. Right now, most of it right now is the hydroelectric. So again, like 89% of the, or sorry, I guess just repeat the question. So the question was about in terms of their installed capacity and how that's broken down in terms of, because obviously the generation business is where they're generating a lot of their cash flows. So right now, again, the Brazilian market, 89% is hydroelectric, and that's pretty consistent with their installed base right now. And they have these wind operations now that that are coming through. They made a purchase in 2009 for that, and then they have two coming on board in 2010. So smaller wind operations, but again, that's where that CapEx is going, 54%. And then they also have that biomass, and those are through those legislative initiatives that the Brazilian government's kind of pushing forward. We're good? Short on time.
Very good.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yes. There is a 1.5 slot
Hi, I'm Gregory Randolph. I'm a junior analyst on Dislatel Capital Management Fund, and today I'm here to present Bombardier, ticker symbol BBD.B. So the company overview, it's a manufacturer of transportation equipment with two divisions. One is Bombardier Transport, which is rolling stock and rail services. The other one is Bombardier Aerospace, which is the aviation products and related services division. So first and foremost, I'd like to start off by saying that given the time constraints of this presentation, I'm going to focus solely on the pieces of value that I think the Wall Street is mispricing rather than give focus to the qualitative aspects of Bombardier that I think every investor has already priced in. So I'm going to try and show why I think that analyst estimates are mispricing the stock. So first and second and foremost, my investment thesis is a price target of $850 to $950 by the end of 2010. The range is based on a two-way sensitivity analysis between margin growth and multiple expansion. So essentially, I'm looking for earnings multiple growth. It's currently trading at the biggest ever discount it has to the S&P. And so I believe this is unjustified because I think that there are growth opportunities that the street is not pricing in on both the cost side with aggressive margin expansion and on the sales side with the C-Series, which I think that the market has yet to price in at all, as was evidenced about 2 weeks ago when Republic Airways put in an order. And based on the incremental earnings that would generate, the entire incremental earnings stream was priced into the was added to the value of the stock, meaning no new deals have been priced into Bombardier, which I think is severely underpricing their opportunities. So the bulk of my model, was an income statement pro forma forecasting. So given that the two divisions face very different business risks, I decided to forecast them differently. For BT, you have the less cyclical division of Bombardier. More recently, the economic downturn has spurred a great deal of infrastructure spending in Europe and North America, and as well there's rapid rail infrastructure expansion in both China and India. So how I forecasted it was I took the weighted average of the growth forecast of the GDP, but I made adjustment factors based on aggregate industry data from the Economist Intelligence Unit, from GMID, from various sources. And it said there was a lot of studies about the percentage of GDP increases that would be used towards infrastructure spending. So I adjusted the GDP forecast one way or another for that, as well as used some discretion for external events that I don't think the market was pricing in, like Brazil and the World Cup and rapid Chinese and Indian urbanization, which is going to create traffic problems and demand for Bombardier's products such as their mass transit networks. And as well, the recently announced and further confirmed U.S.-Canadian high-speed rail networks. In the States, $8 billion is committed to 13 high-speed corridors in the United States, and I think this presents an excellent opportunity for Bombardier. In terms of forecasting for BA, they're divided into two primary segments. There's the commercial or regional jets and the business jets. So the business jets face significant headwinds. They're directly related to corporate profitability. And I think the decreased corporate profitability going forward is leading to more demand for used jets, which is squeezing BA's margin, as well as the public outrage over corporate perks is certainly going to dampen demand for business jets, at least for the next few years, before public memory is erased. And then for the commercial segment, I think that the C-series is a primary value driver, which, like I said before, based on the way the stock reacts to new orders, the market is virtually entirely neglected. So it's positioned in a niche seat segment of 110 to 130, which is smaller than the bigger competitors like Boeing and Airbus, but bigger than the Embraer ERJ series. It's got the real selling point, in my opinion, is the 20% lower fuel consumption, which translates into 15% lower operating costs with oil at $100 a barrel. But if you do a sensitivity analysis and crank oil up to $150 a barrel, you have a very cost-efficient plane in the C-series. It's also, based on its lower fuel consumption, it's the least polluting regional jet, and so that may garner further subsidies going forward. And it's also the most spacious narrow-body design ever manufactured. So it's unlike the bigger planes which you've been on, which have two rows and generally more legroom. This is a narrow plane with that sort of design, so it's got the capacity of a regional jet but the comfort of a larger jumbo jet, which is actually revolutionary. So then the other important thesis for my investment was the margin increases. So I was forecasting increasing margins based on two different things that I've observed. The first one is the managerial guidance. So they have, for the last few years, they've had in place something called the AES, which is the Achieving Excellence System. It's a terrible name, but actually a great idea. And so essentially what it's doing is it's reducing bureaucracy in Bombardier, which has for a long time hampered their profitability by increasing SG&A charges. So recent examples of that is BT, Bombardier Transport, used to have six divisional head offices. Now they've reduced that down to two. I believe the same is in place for Bombardier Aerospace. They're going to undergo similar streamlining. Additionally, historically, they've had stickiness in their labor force is that because of the amount of subsidies they garner for their production from federal governments, they've had a lot of trouble laying off workers. Recently, with the economic downturn, they were finally able to lay off 4,400 workers, and this signals a new paradigm in terms of their ability to lay off workers when they are unnecessary, and that will further increase margins. Additionally, they've managed to negotiate with the federal governments also to do some aggressive outsourcing to low-cost production countries. So all this, I think, is going to further increase margins going forward. And just historically, based on a trend extrapolation, we've seen that the AES system has been working. They have over 5 years now of rather consistent margin expansion. And additionally, they're reverting towards their peer group. There's really no reason. They've consistently had a lower operating margin than Embraer in their aerospace segment and then Alstom in their transport segment. And there's really no systematic reason why they should be why that should be the case. And they've been closing the gap. So in terms of my model assumptions, I didn't look towards total peer reversion. But they, by 2012, when the AES has run its course, I looked to them slightly lower EBIT margins than their competitors, but still higher than it is today, and lower than managerial guidance of 9%. So I used 7% by 12. So then all that is in terms of the valuation. So by virtue of the very cyclical nature of BA rather than BT, which generally seems to drive the stock price, Bombardier coming out of a recession tends to have its valuation smashed only to promptly reverse. In the last few recessions, we've seen V-shaped recoveries in its valuation, and I'm looking for that now. I think that the market, again, has inappropriately abused Bombardier for the fact that its BT segment is not only not cyclical, I believe to some extent it's become counter-cyclical, because the resurgence of Keynesian economics in a lot of Western economies, which you have is increased infrastructure spending during times of economic downturns that we've seen recently. So that's really going to buffet Bombardier's transport division. And also the incremental earnings growth that I see from the C-Series means that essentially it's, in my opinion, trading at the lowest PEG ratio it has historically. So I don't think Wall Street's pricing in earnings growth appropriately, and I also don't think that they're pricing in the stability of that BT's cash flows offer properly when applying a multiple. So here we have a very small two-way sensitivity analysis. Should have been maybe stretched out a bit. But it's the two primary drivers of value that I mentioned was the EBIT margin versus PE. So trading at the mid-range of my EPS margin, of my EBIT margin of 6.5%, and either it's a long-run median multiple or the average S&P multiple, it should have a price of 908. So as I showed before, historically, Bombardier is very seldom traded at a discount to the S&P, and it's currently trading at the biggest ever discount. So looking for some reversion and multiple appreciation. the stock looks set to be at least an 850 to 950 stock in 2010. And as oil prices increase in the future and the C-Series gives more incremental earnings to the stock, I like its long-term prospects beyond 2010. So relative valuation, there's no direct competitor because, I mean, on the aerospace, you can see Embraer is a direct competitor in terms of its transport. You can look at Alstom, certain divisions of Siemens to some extent. So Bombardier is essentially trading at a bit of a Bombardier is trading at a higher earnings multiple than Embraer, but I believe this is justified as they have higher growth through the C-Series. So for that reason, the 11 multiple is certainly justified. And just to add, in terms of their capital structure, their debt-to-equity ratio is 39.2%, as listed on various websites. But I think that adjustments have to be made for operating leases, so they were capitalized, and the present value of those operating leases is $416 million. They also have a massive underfunded pension of $1.7 billion. A lot of that is as a result of the market last year. The pension deficit grew, but they haven't really closed it going into 2009, so that's a problem going forward. So a more adjusted debt-to-equity ratio, in my opinion, would be 60%. And that's something to watch. But they also have a lot of cash. They have about $3.5 billion, so their net debt position is actually only $500 million. And just recently, they were able to refinance their debt. It's what a difference a month can make. A month ago, they had to revoke their tender offer because they couldn't do it for under 8%. And now they managed to do it. So I think they took advantage of lower spreads to lower the cost of capital. And so that was definitely a good thing for Bombardier going forward. And finally, just some potential risks and opportunities. The potential of lower oil prices in the near term, which I think is unlikely, would reduce the attractiveness of the C-Series and rail transportation. Another problem is a big thing with BT is that 80% of their clients were deemed investment grade and never to default. But recently, with Greece on the verge of default and the pigs countries in Europe, it turns out that a lot of their customers who were previously assumed to be impossible to default may or may not actually have trouble paying their bills in the near future. So that's certainly something to watch. And the other thing is that a lot of their high-speed rail corridors are going through the same routes that the regional jets, like the C-Series, are going to fly. And the high-speed jets going at, with the high-speed rail going at approximately the same time as some of the plane voyages, there's a chance that they would cannibalize the regional jet business with some of the high-speed corridors. I don't think it's a huge step, but it's certainly something to look at going forward. And in terms of the opportunities, which I think far outweigh the risks, we have developing nations urbanization, which is going to increase the demand for subway construction, for mass transit. There's going to be a bunch of mega cities forming with incredible demands on the existing infrastructure, and it's going to be very difficult for them to dig up and rebuild all their own roads. The only alternative will be mass transit, which Bombardier is poised to take advantage of. The more likely scenario, as pointed out by our macro analyst and our oil analyst, is that higher oil prices in the future will make the C-Series incredibly efficient for airliners who need to have the best margins possible. So for that reason, the C-Series is going to garner a lot of attention. Developing nations' massive infrastructure spending, and specifically, which was not mentioned in the annual report, which is the reason I think Wall Street may have missed this, is the age of the rolling stock, which is the trains and the metros, and the regional jet fleets actually signal imminent replacement. The average age of rolling stock in Europe is 25 years. Generally, they have a 30-year life cycle, so that's going to be a big thing for Bombardier going forward. And the regional jets also are going to need replacement soon. So I think that that's going to be a huge source of unforeseen growth for Bombardier. Thank you, and if there's any cues, I'll hopefully have an A. Q.
You have a pop up, so you have like declining growth 2010 over 2009. And if that's your rosy scenario, how does that scenario stack up against what consensus estimates are for those
years? Sure. So the question was the C series, in my opinion, is obviously a primary catalyst for growth. But based on my income statement model, there's substantial decreases in earnings. So how does that measure up to my thesis? The quick answer for that is the income statement model is not valuing the C-Series. The C-Series is being valued separately as an incremental stream of earnings on top of this. And since the orders were very difficult to forecast, the best way to value a project that they have still the ability how one of the evaluation techniques I use, they still have the ability to cancel the project and defer a lot of expenditures. And so you can get, so I valued it as it's just a call option basically on the incremental earnings or cash flow stream of the project. So my mission here with the income statement model was to find value in Bombardier without the C-Series, and so if I could find value there and then add the incremental value of the C-Series onto it, then it looked like a strong buy. So basically, in terms of measuring up to the consensus estimates, my 2010 had a lower earnings per share than the consensus, because I forecasted a bigger drop in business jets than the mean analyst forecasted. The reason for that is, if you look at the analyst forecast, they were all within 4 cents. I think the mean analyst forecast was, 3 or 4 cents higher. I don't know the exact figure, but I could grab it for you.
I guess the question is, if you added it back, if you put your C-Series in there, because I assume the stream...
I would definitely be above the mean analyst forecast if I were to add the income. Within 5 to 10 cents in all 3 years. But the reason for these depressed values is, in terms of the existing business lines, I did forecast lower business jet profitability. If you look at the analysts, they initially were forecasting a 10% year-over-year drop, then a 15%, then 25%. They've been continuously downgrading their forecast for business jets. So I basically just one-upped them and did what I assume will be their next step in the downgrading. I did about 35% drop off year-over-year.
Now, percentage differential in earnings, would that be the same thing with the top line as well?
With the top line, no, it wouldn't be exactly identical, because I was forecasting increasing margins. That was a forecast assumption.
Hi, my name is Michael Marzell. I'll be presenting Covidien. The company overview, the company is in healthcare. It's a large medical device maker and supplier. It's actually it's separated into three divisions. One is medical devices, which is their main one, but they're also involved in the production of certain pharmaceuticals, and there is a significant supplier of medical supplies to the hospitals. Just some key statistics. It's a large cap, 25 billion market capitalization. The revenue, most recent, was close to 11 billion. The return on equity was 11.5%, and the dividend yield was 1.4%. If you look at the revenue by segments, and we have the 2004-2008 revenue mix, you can see that the vast majority of their sales are in medical devices, which account for almost 60%, with a slight increase between those two periods, and the remainder of medical supplies and pharmaceuticals. And you can see that there's been some consolidation. They fused their medical supplies and retail products into medical supplies, and then the pharmaceuticals and imaging solutions have been put together into the pharmaceutical segment. The company is... has a significant international presence outside of the U.S., and they've been expanding aggressively to both Europe and Asia. You can see a significant increase in Europe from 20 to almost 30%, and that's something that they're also trying to replicate in some of the emerging markets. So I see an additional value in this firm over what's it traditionally been priced at, because of the renewed focus on several key strategies. One thing is that they're currently expanding their R&D expenditures in order to boost growth, and they're focusing on some of the high margin segments. They're also increasing their sales force to support increased in projected sales. They're highly focused on innovation, and that was one of their key points on the to the September 2009 Analyst Day. The way they're going to go about with innovation is through both the in-house research developments and as well as some strategic acquisitions. And here I just wanted to touch on one product that was actually of particular interest to me, that that I noticed that this company was developing and actually got an FDA approval very recently for. They have aggressive marketing going in right now. In the United States, it's a single port laparoscopy device, And what that does is that it allows the actors to operate through a single incision on many of the abdominal cases. That's a significant improvement over the current technology that allows people to have minimally invasive procedures through four ports. And I think it's just an example of how COVIDian is trying not only to, sell their standard line of products, but also improve of what's currently being done and simply revolutionize some of the procedures that are currently being performed in the surgical setting. They're also trying to leverage their global structure. As you can see, they're expanding into some of the emerging markets, and that's particularly interesting because of their pharmaceutical segment that is on top of their medical device segment. They're expanding into emerging markets, and actually their pharmaceutical segment is contains a lot of the generics, which are actually expected to grow enormously in the emerging markets. So that's one of the strengths of the firm. Some of the recent management initiatives, like Six Sigma and Lean Manufacturing, are trying to drive down the cost and increase the margins. And lastly, through the some of the strategic acquisitions, they're trying to enhance their portfolio of products in such a way that that they could be selling their products along with the acquisition products, and therefore increase both sales at the same time. One example is their new acquisition for a brain imaging device that goes along with some of the products and imaging that they had before, and it's a supplementary to some of the surgical procedures that they can be performing. So it's something that will be a competitive advantage in their surgical segment, and just an example of how efficient their acquisition strategy is. If you look at the stock performance, it's done quite nicely. It's a very robust performance over the past 12 months, with a recent plateau. And I think that I will touch on why I think there's been a decline in growth very recently. If you look at the if you compare COVIDian to other medical device companies, you can see that they're quite an attractive buy in terms of the current PE ratio. There is the lowest in the group. And looking at the forward PEs, they're only higher than one, which is Baxter, which could be explained to some extent by the by their higher beta. But at the same time, they're exhibiting a lower debt equity ratio. And overall, it's a very very attractive picture from a perspective of comparing this company to their main competitors. If you look at their current PE ratio, it's right now 14.9. Historically, the average has been 15.1, and in fact, in 2008, it reached a level of well above 20. So this company certainly has a potential for a PE expansion. So the valuation here is based on the projected EPS of 3.4 and a target PE forward-looking of about 17. Which is based on the assumptions of significant growth in medical devices. The range for that growth is between 7 and 10%, which is their main segment of revenues. The pharmaceutical segment is actually expected to possibly shrink or grow very mildly, and that's primarily because of some of the divesting activity that's happening in that segment. They're actually trying to decrease their contrast product line, which is having a very low margin, and increase some of the generic segment. And what's interesting about their strategy is that they're actually implementing a very innovative technologies that will be combined with their generic drugs, and that's supposed to be increasing their margins. So their strategy is to shift from the low margin, medical supply like. Products to brand pharmaceuticals through an addition of technology that is in-house developed and fairly predictable, because it's not like a new drug development. It's simply taking a generic drug and applying certain technologies to it. Like, for example, we have seen an FDA approval of one of their medications. It's called Exagil, which is an opioid medication, which is a generic drug, but they applied a very sophisticated release technology to it, which will probably account for a margin expansion in that segment. And the medical supplies are supposed to grow at 2 to 5%, which is pretty stable. The main risks that I see with this company are hospital expenditures, and that's certainly something that applies to all the medical device companies. There's certainly an economic recovery in the U.S., and currently it's expected that the trends in the hospitals are supposed to increase. However, it's not completely certain, and there's certainly a lot of questioning of which products the hospitals will be buying first. It's typically expected that the medical devices, generally speaking, in the U.S., are expected to grow by 9%, which is fairly optimistic, with high overperformance over pharmaceuticals. So that's obviously a good sign. As you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around the U.S. healthcare reform, and I think that's what is driving the price down right now and discounting it significantly. The U.S. healthcare reform is very complex and is very difficult to simply say that it will affect this company positively or negatively. I think that you have to look at the bill specifically and see what's in it. I think that the additional coverage is certainly a good thing for any company in the sector, but additional taxes that are supposed to be imposed on some of the large cap pharmaceuticals and medical device firms could certainly decrease their net income. It's a globally diversified firm, so certainly that's a plus in terms of their ability to expand into emerging economies, etc. But we're certainly at a foreign exchange exposure. About 20% of their revenues are currently in euros. 60% are in the U.S. currency, and that's something to keep in mind. And then lastly, something that I already mentioned, in the pharmaceutical segment, some of the subsegments like contrast products, etc., are subject to significant price competition, especially right now. And so I believe that their strategy from divesting from these products and going into others is a good strategy. At the same time, in the short run, certainly a significant risk. So something to look for. That's all. Yes.
In your stock chart, you have a significant increase in volume in June
09. June 09.
I think it was
right. No, so you go back.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. Yeah. Quite frankly, I'm not sure what that activity was. Yes.
Well,
they're certainly the highest margin. It's probably going to be at least in that range.
Okay. And in that question, on the devices side, what is your area of specialization on the device side?
Oh, there's mostly surgical products. So they have a significant amount of laparoscopic devices. They have some of the surgical monitoring. They have significant laparoscopy.
So
and
with GE, Siemens, a lot of the big players, plus
Baxter, Bardia, for some of their products. Obviously, these Siemens, etc., they also have a significant imaging section, but they don't make these kinds of things. But they have, a lot of those subsegments, certainly.
So my last question is, just in terms of the valuation slide, given that the PE is basically the same year over year, which means that there's no growth.
Well, the PEs have been changing. This is right now when you're looking. What do you mean from year to year? This is the current PE, and then we have a forward-looking PE.
Right. So
and that's
PE,
the, right
PE
now.
PE trailing 12-month, 14.9. PE trailing, that means it's a marginal increase in earnings year over year.
From this year to the next, it's expected that given the slowness of the recovery, it's not going to be a large increase in EPS. But I think that the growth is forecasted for almost 11, and that's going to be priced into the PE expansion.
So is their growth in 11 then greater than, say, Bard or Baxter, which have, it appears to have, like, those two guys
yeah.
have significantly better earnings per share growth forward versus last year?
Sorry, Baxter, from going from the current PE of 15.4
to 13.7.
Right.
So you got a nice pickup in earnings, and in the case mm-hmm. of Bard, the same thing, 16.3 to almost at 15, you got a pickup in earnings there, while Covidien is essentially flat in earnings. So what I'm saying is, like,
right.
if you go past the 2011, the earnings growth for Covidien better than Bard or Baxter, or is it just the same?
Well, looking at the... if I recall correctly, looking at their forward PEs for that 12-month target price to 011, it was considerably higher because we're looking at a PE of about possibly 17 for Covidien and slightly much lower for the remainders. So we're looking at the earnings growth that will be exceeding the other ones. So, I mean, I can't really give you the comparable numbers, but you don't know for sure. For sure, yeah.